made short work of the Iraqi army. For Nagel, however, that early sense of triumph was short-lived. A year after Desert Storm, he recalls, he found himself at the Army's National Training Center in California. Pitted against an infantry company from the Alaska National Guard in a simulated battle, Nagel's company of proud Gulf War veterans assumed they would easily prevail over the ragtag Alaskan guardsmen, many of whom didn't even speak understandable English. Instead, something astonishing happened. The Nanooks, as Nagel's experienced tankers dubbed the Alaskans, crept up on us from behind, infiltrating through the mountains that protected our flanks and rear from enemy armored vehicles, but not from Eskimos. Methodically, one by one, the Nanooks defeated a dug-in tank company. Nagel was frustrated and bewildered. Somehow, it turned out, the world's most advanced ground combat systems, M1A1 tanks that only a year earlier had defeated the world's fourth largest army on its home turf with ease, were perversely vulnerable to small bands of determined human enemies whose language we could barely understand, but who knew our vulnerabilities. The experience sent him back to graduate school, determined to gain a better understanding of insurgencies and irregular warfare. Nagel's 1997 dissertation, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, focused on counterinsurgency lessons from Malaya and Vietnam. At first, he couldn't find a publisher. No one was interested in a book on how armies learn to succeed in counterinsurgency. That didn't change until the Iraq War, when, faced with a baffling and unexpected insurgency instead of the anticipated cakewalk, many of America's top officers began to have their own version of Nagel's epiphany after his mock defeat by the Nanooks. Suddenly, counterinsurgency, shortened to COIN, was all the rage. Nagel's dissertation, which had finally been published as a book called Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, became an instant COIN classic, and everyone who was anyone in military circles longed to join the COINdanistas, as Nagel and other architects of the COIN revolution jokingly dubbed themselves. The COINdanistas argued that legitimacy is the main objective for any military force seeking to defeat an insurgency. In a 2006 article in the Military Review, Nagel and three co-authors argued that in COIN, purely military considerations should never trump political objectives, and the military must learn to coordinate and combine its efforts with civilian and multinational actors. COIN also de-emphasized offensive military action. The cornerstone of any COIN effort is security for the populace. Without security, no permanent reforms can be implemented, and disorder will spread. To establish legitimacy, security activities must move from the realm of major combat operations into the realm of law enforcement. It is best to use the minimum possible force in resolving any situation. The more force you use, the less effective you are. This was a far cry from Samuel Huntington's insistence that the purpose of the military was to kill people in the most efficient way possible. On the contrary, the COINdanistas emphasized the need for military personnel to move outside their comfort zones. As Nagel and his co-authors argued in their Military Review article, security is important in setting the stage for other kinds of progress, but lasting victory will come from a vibrant economy, political participation, and restored hope. Dollars and ballots will have a more important effect than bombs and bullets. Information is even more powerful when correctly wielded. T.E. Lawrence once observed that the printing press is the greatest weapon in the armory of the modern commander. This is even truer today than it was when Lawrence wrote it nearly a century ago. Except that the truly effective counterinsurgent requires not just a printing press, but radio and television programs and an internet presence. Soldiers and Marines must be prepared to engage in a host of traditionally non-military missions to support COIN operations. The language wasn't calculated to bring joy to civilian State Department officials, but these precepts soon found their way into the Army and Marine Corps' Counterinsurgency Field Manual, which Nagel was tapped by General David Petraeus to help draft. When it was published in 2007, the Army's COIN manual even became an improbable bestseller, garnering a fulsome review in the New York Times and even catapulting a uniformed Nagel onto Jon Stewart's Daily Show. In the mid and late 2000s, COIN's emphasis on traditionally non-military missions, such as population protection, basic services, and the establishment of legitimate governance, fueled a surge of military interest in everything from rule of law programs to strategic communication. In Afghanistan and Iraq, commanders urged troops to get out from the safety of their bases and mingle with the people. General Petraeus, the commander in Iraq in 2007, reminded the troops that this fight depends on securing the population, which must understand that we, not our enemies, occupy the moral high ground. And in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, who took over as commander of U.S. forces in summer 2009, immediately issued a directive reminding troops that this is a struggle for the support of the population. We must respect and protect the population from coercion and violence. This is different from conventional combat. Ultimately, he asserted, working with our Afghan partners, we will overcome the enemy's influence and give the Afghan people what they deserve, a country at peace, the foundations of good governance, and economic development. In Iraq and Afghanistan, 1,000 coin-related flowers bloomed. Military engineers dug wells and fixed sewer lines. Civil affairs teams refurbished schools, attended meetings of local tribal elders, and started microfinance projects for rural women. Psychological operations units distributed radio station in a box kits and scoured the countryside for credible voices to put on call-in shows. Military agriculture experts encouraged Afghans to diversify their crops, and military medical teams staffed women's health clinics. You name it, the military was doing it. You people. But putting coin precepts into practice proved anything but easy. John Noggle noted ruefully, I thought I'd known something about coin until I started trying to do it myself. And as with AFRICOM and stability operations, few coin-related efforts were an unmitigated success. Displaced civilian diplomats and development experts were often harshly critical of DOD's humanitarian, development, and governance work. Stories abounded of schools built without thought for whether they would have teachers, books, or students. Bridges built 3 times in a row in the same place, only to be repeatedly demolished by local contractors who knew the next military unit that rotated in would pay them to rebuild it yet again. You people, you just have no idea what you're doing, a USAID development expert spluttered to me after a meeting convened by the White House on revamping development policy. You've got these kids, these 30-year-old captains who've spent their lives learning to drive tanks and shoot people, and they think they know how to end poverty in Afghanistan in 6 months. They don't understand that there are people who actually know something about this, and it's not them. They act on whatever idea happens to pop into their heads. Formal efforts to evaluate non-traditional military programs have offered only mixed reviews. A 2011 Government Accountability Office report on DOD humanitarian activities, for instance, found systemic management and accountability problems across the Defense Department, concluding grimly that while there have been some improvements over the years, DOD does not have complete information on the full range of humanitarian assistance projects it conducts. DOD does not know when a project is going to be implemented, when it is in progress, or when and if it has been completed. DOD does not know how much it has spent. DOD is not consistently evaluating its projects, and therefore it cannot determine whether its humanitarian assistance efforts are meeting their intended goals, having positive effects, or represent an efficient use of resources. A later Government Accountability Office report addressing development activities in Afghanistan reached similar conclusions. Criticism of this kind also came from humanitarian assistance NGOs such as Doctors Without Borders, the Red Cross, and Save the Children. These groups worried about what they saw as the militarization of aid and the shrinking of humanitarian space. A core tenet for most humanitarian NGOs is neutrality. Aid workers don't take sides in conflicts. Food and medical aid is distributed without regard to ideology or affiliation. Neutrality is embraced by humanitarian organizations for practical reasons as well as principled ones. Aid workers are far less likely to be targeted by participants in a conflict if they are viewed as above the fray. When military personnel start handing out humanitarian assistance, many NGOs argue local actors can no longer assume that aid is neutral. Instead, aid becomes an instrument of war, and aid agency personnel become targets. It's not a misplaced fear. In the decade between 2003 and 2013, 991 humanitarian workers were killed, 236 in Afghanistan. Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, Yemen, Congo, Palestine, Uganda, and Syria have also proved particularly lethal places for aid workers in recent years. Jagged little pieces. At best, the military has a mixed track record when it comes to performing such traditionally civilian functions as providing humanitarian assistance, governance support, and development aid. But though part of the problem is surely military ineptitude, clueless young officers managing tasks for which they have little instinct and less training, it's not the military that sets national security policy, and it's not the military that sets the nation's budgetary priorities. Without strong political leadership, sensible strategic goals, and partnerships with capable, well-funded, and adaptable civilian agencies, none of which the United States has had, military initiatives can only do so much. To quote Hillary Clinton, it takes a village. Or more precisely, it takes a whole government to really screw up a war. A dollop of American hubris goes a long way, too. On the other hand, sometimes I think it's our best instincts that lead to our worst failures. Consider Iraq. Granted, some not-so-great instincts brought us there in 2003, but it was our best instincts that kept us there. Remember, you break it, you own it? We took the Pottery Barn rule seriously enough to stick around for the next 8 years, trying earnestly to glue the shattered pieces back together. The glue never stuck. We couldn't bring ourselves to believe gloomy predictions that looting might take place, and we convinced ourselves the Iraqis would be better off if we could just oust senior members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist party from the government and disband his army. But instead of bringing peace and democracy, early U.S. decisions in Iraq led to chaos, revenge killings, a government that could no longer provide the most basic services, and millions of angry, unemployed, and armed young men. It only got worse. The continued American presence sparked an insurgency and brought al-Qaeda to Iraq. While the Iraq War's civilian death toll remains disputed, it was certainly stunningly high. Violence began gradually to subside after 2006, for reasons that probably had more to do with the internal changes in Iraq's Sunni community, known as the Sunni Awakening, than with the U.S. troop surge. And in 2011, we finally slunk off, tails between our legs. Behind us, we left a squabbling, barely functional government, an economy in shambles, and a level of civil violence that remains astronomically high. Now we're back in Iraq again, this time with a few thousand military advisors and air power rather than scores of thousands of combat troops. And this time we're fighting ISIS, not al-Qaeda or Shiite militias. But we still can't put the country back together again. And the Iraqi troops we so expensively trained and equipped seem disinclined to fight the battles we want them to fight. My point here is not that the Iraq War was a bad idea in the first place, though certainly it was. My point is that this cynical, foolish, arguably illegal war might still have come right in the end, if only we had tried a little less hard to fix everything that struck us as broken. I remember Iraq in summer 2003, before the bombing of the UN headquarters, before suicide bombs and IEDs became near daily occurrences. There was a brief window that spring and summer, a window in which the mood in Baghdad was cautiously celebratory. People spoke freely. NGOs and human rights groups popped up out of nowhere. Saddam was out. Hope was in. We should have left then. What would have happened if the U.S. government had been less determined to fix Iraq's broken parts? What would have happened if we'd brought our troops back home in summer 2003? What if we'd quelled our national do-gooder instincts and left the Iraqi army and all but a handful of top Ba'athist officials in place, offering the rest their lives, liberty, and some generous economic assistance in exchange for genuine cooperation on weapons inspections? There's no way to know for sure, but I have an uneasy feeling that a more cynical U.S. government approach from the get-go, an approach that never even contemplated the restoration of democracy, might ultimately have caused less chaos and bloodshed. Or consider Afghanistan. Since 2001, we've struggled to keep the Taliban at bay, build up a democratic government, eliminate corruption, and create an Afghan military capable of defending the population and disinclined to prey on it. All worthy aims. And to achieve them, Presidents Bush and Obama let U.S. troop levels creep up over the course of 11 years, going from fewer than 10,000 in late 2002 to more than 30,000 in November 2008. By mid-2009, Obama had doubled that number. By mid-2010, he had tripled it. But though we did substantially increase the number of U.S. civilian officials tasked to help with Afghan governance and development issues, the civilian surge never got very surge-like. In his book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, Rajiv Chandrasekaran quotes Brigadier General Kenneth Dahl's sarcastic 2011 rejoinder to Carl Eikenberry, then the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, who informed him that the civilian surge had reached the high water mark. "That's great," Dahl responded. "I can feel it lapping at my ankles." The result? Today, the Afghan government remains corrupt, insecurity remains rampant, civilian deaths directly and indirectly attributable to the U.S. presence remain high, and polls suggest that ordinary Afghans are scared of American soldiers. If the Afghan population doesn't trust us much, we've come to trust them even less. Green-on-blue attacks spiked in the final years of the war. As in Iraq, we ended up limping ignominiously toward the exit. But in Afghanistan, as in Iraq, ending the war has so far proven impossible. As I write, Taliban forces have regained control of more Afghan territory than at any time since the U.S. invasion in 2001, and ISIS now competes with the Taliban for territory and influence. U.S. troops remain engaged in hostilities inside Afghanistan, and recent White House announcements make it clear that their role and numbers are likely to continue to expand. What if the United States had done things differently? What if we had pummeled al-Qaeda's strongholds, helped the Northern Alliance oust the Taliban, and then left? If we had left early in 2002, we could have continued to strike al-Qaeda targets of opportunity as needed, using special operations forces and aerial attacks. We could have used diplomacy and foreign aid to urge governance and human rights reforms. Perhaps there wouldn't have been many reforms, but would things really be any worse than they are today? Here again, my point isn't that the war in Afghanistan was a mistake, or that our efforts in Afghanistan have fallen badly short, an argument that has been made often and persuasively. Nor am I arguing that we're now less safe than we used to be, or insufficiently more safe, claims that have always struck me as hard to prove one way or the other. My point is that it has often been our best instincts, not our worst, that have led us to do harm in the world. In Afghanistan and Iraq, we spent billions of dollars and suffered thousands of American casualties. Worst of all, we caused untold suffering for the very populations we so earnestly intended to help. The United States isn't all idealism all the time. We're capable of plenty of cynicism and occasional acts of plain old evil. But even our most cynical moments are accompanied by idealism. We want to help and we want to set things right. We want everyone to share in peace, justice, and the benefits of the American way, even if it hurts. And hurt it does. The United States and those we try to help are often the victims of our own idealistic commitments to democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. This phenomenon plays out at a micro level as well as a macro level. Military construction and economic development projects take far too long and cost far too much, in part because we want everything to satisfy stringent U.S. and international quality standards. Our reconstruction projects are so elaborate that only those Afghans who already have wealth and power have the capacity to serve as subcontractors. By and large, the result is that power is concentrated even more in the hands of the often corrupt and violent few. Even U.S. military detention facilities in Afghanistan were built to Western specifications, complete with climate control systems and electronic security. As a result, we render them virtually useless for the Afghan officials who will inherit them, and who won't have the trained staff or the unlimited supply of electrical power to make them run. But the suggestion that the Afghans might sometimes be better off with less reeks, to us, of unacceptable double standards. Or consider a larger and more tragic irony. By late 2009, the United States had embarked on a counterinsurgency-influenced approach to the conflict in Afghanistan. The Afghan population, we decided, was the center of gravity. Our success or failure would depend on our ability to protect the population and enable the Afghan government to provide services and thus build legitimacy. Laudable goals. But by making the Afghan population the center of gravity, we also inadvertently placed the Afghan population at the center of a big red bullseye. We incentivized the Taliban to combat our efforts by placing IEDs in civilian structures and targeting police, courts, governance, and economic development projects. They did so with a vengeance. It should be no surprise if we often fail to achieve our idealistic goals. After all, building a culture that respects human rights, democracy, and the rule of law takes time. Our own imperfect form of democracy, rife as it still is with injustice and corruption, took us more than 2 centuries to build, though we stood on the shoulders of those who drafted the Magna Carta and the English Bill of Rights. So why should we imagine that durable change could come any faster in societies that start with far less? Less wealth, less education, less tradition of democratic government, human rights, or peaceful change. Simple failure to achieve our loftiest goals could be excused, but if our efforts to help only cause more harm, it's inexcusable. Scarred by Vietnam, my parents' generation came of age with a deep distrust of American power. They suspected that American interventionism never stemmed from pure motives and never, ever ended well. My generation came of age at a more hopeful moment. I was a college student when the Berlin Wall came down, and the notion of non-ideological U.S. engagement with the world seemed suddenly possible again. The Rwandan genocide taught my generation that non-intervention can be as unconscionable as meddling, and Bosnia and Kosovo taught us that U.S. military power could be a force for good. But after all the waste and bloodshed in Iraq and Afghanistan, I've lost much of my faith in our government's ability to restore peace or bring justice. I'd love to be proved wrong, but here's my fear. The more we try to fix things, the more we end up shattering them into jagged little pieces. An expensive proposition. It was virtually inevitable that post-9/11 changes in military doctrine and activities would lead to civilian military tensions. After 9/11, resources and authorities flowed to the Pentagon. The Bush administration always wanted military guys between themselves and whatever the problem was, recalls a retired general who served in senior positions during that period and was more than willing to pour money into DOD. 10 to 15 years ago, the military was much smaller and less holistic, comments retired Lieutenant General Dave Barno. Today, you have a more empowered military. It has expanded both in ways intended and not. Meanwhile, budgets for civilian foreign policy agencies and programs have remained largely stagnant. Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates touched on this theme in a landmark 2007 speech. Consider that this year's budget for the Department of Defense, not counting operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, is nearly $500 billion, while the total foreign affairs budget requested for the State Department is $36 billion. There are only about 6,600 professional foreign service officers, less than the manning for one aircraft carrier strike group. Gates was blunt in his analysis. The gutting of America's soft power institutions has led the Defense Department to take on many of these burdens that might have been assumed by civilian agencies in the past. AFRICOM is a classic case. As the State Department Inspector General's report commented in 2009, AFRICOM's role was resented and challenged by the State Department's African Affairs Bureau. But the military was essentially stepping into a void created by a lack of resources for traditional development and other civilian tasks. It's a vicious circle. As civilian capacity has declined, the military has stepped into the breach. It's just the easiest way out of any problem, retired Major General Paul Eaton told me. Give money to the military and let them deal with it. But the more the military's role expands, the more civilian agencies such as the State Department and USAID find themselves sidelined. In Afghanistan, recalls Eaton, U.S. officials wanted to help the Afghans reform their agricultural sector. Military officials asked the Department of Agriculture to develop a program, but they couldn't spare more than a tiny number of people. So DOD pulled together an agricultural battalion made up of reservists who had agricultural expertise. Is this the best way to handle things like this? Maybe not. But it's the only mechanism we have. DOD has the only available mechanism for marshaling massive amounts of effort and talent. All the same, the ascendancy of counterinsurgency and stability operations doctrine didn't last. Whatever you want to call it, Mutwa nation-building stability operations coin, it's an expensive proposition. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, with hundreds of thousands of troops rotating in and out of theaters, have already cost the nation more than $1.5 trillion. The 2008 financial crisis made open-ended military commitments seem increasingly unaffordable, and the lack of clear success in Iraq and Afghanistan, indeed the many failures, made such commitments more difficult for politicians to justify. From the moment he was elected, President Obama made it clear that his top priority in Iraq was the rapid withdrawal of U.S. combat forces, not an extended counterinsurgency presence. By late 2009, it had become apparent that the war in Afghanistan could not be rapidly turned around, and Obama began to lose patience with this conflict as well. He agreed to send additional troops to Afghanistan at General Stanley McChrystal's request, but insisted publicly that most of those troops would begin to withdraw from Afghanistan 18 months later, come what may. In Washington, talk of counterinsurgency began to give way to talk of targeted counterterrorism drone strikes, a quick, cheap, and seemingly risk-free way for America to rid itself of its enemies. Chapter 5. The Secret War. Much of what the U.S. military does is no secret. If the general public is largely unaware of the expanding scope of military activities, it's mainly due to lack of interest. If you want to know the size of the military, how much military personnel are paid, or how much it costs to provide military health care, you can do a bit of Googling and the answers will be at your fingertips. If you want details of military humanitarian assistance in Indonesia, military technical assistance to the Afghan government, or military deaths in Afghanistan, that's available too. Joint Forces Doctrine, Marine Corps Equipment Lists, the curriculum at the Army's Ranger School, a map of Fort Carson. It's all a quick Google search away. But the military operates secret programs too. And top secret programs, and programs so terribly secret and sensitive that details are available only to those possessing the requisite code word clearances. Special access programs are governed by tight rules specifying how information is held and accessed. Some special access programs are unacknowledged. That is, the military will not only withhold details about the program from those without the requisite clearances and need to know, they will even deny that the program exists in the first place. Waived, unacknowledged special access programs are even more tightly controlled. These programs aren't even reported to the full congressional oversight committees, but only to the committee chairs and ranking members of the relevant committees. Some things have to be secret. Let's say the United States develops the capability to selectively interfere with an enemy's GPS technologies, for instance, making sure that any GPS data is just a little bit off, thus preventing the enemy from coordinating geographically or effectively targeting U.S. positions. I made this up, by the way. I have no idea if such a capability exists. If our ability to do this was known, enemies could compensate in other ways or develop countermeasures. Such a capability would lose much of its value if it didn't stay secret. But some of the things the government keeps secret shouldn't be secret, or at least shouldn't be as secret as they are. In particular, the intentional killing of large numbers of people by the government should not be kept secret. Yet since 9/11, larger and larger swaths of national security policy have essentially vanished into the covert world, and it is in this realm of shadows that we find some of the most dangerous and lethal consequences of the hazy lines between war and not war. Things fall out of the sky. At Nevada's Creech Air Force Base, young Americans sit before computer terminals dispensing remote-controlled death. Drones, or remotely piloted vehicles, in the preferred Air Force parlance, hover over potential targets in faraway countries, and the pilots and technicians at Creech see almost everything, thanks to the sophisticated cameras mounted on the Predator and Reaper drones they control. They see vehicles coming and going. They watch boys herding goats and women carrying goods from the market. They see parents playing with their children and armed men conferring in dusty compounds. Mostly, the clean-cut men and women at Creech just observe, taking 8-hour shifts as they watch endlessly unfolding images of lives lived far away. Occasionally, though, they act, and with a few computer commands and a puff of smoke viewed on a video monitor, lives end in a burst of noise and searing heat. America's drone war began in November 2002 on an isolated stretch of road in Yemen's northwestern Marib province. One minute, a jeep containing 6 men drove sedately along. The next minute, the jeep was nothing but smoldering metal and blasted body parts. Kayed Salim Sinan al-Harethi, believed to be an al-Qaeda leader with links to the 2000 attacks on the USS Cole, was among those reported dead. And among the other dead was an American citizen said to have ties to al-Qaeda. Local witnesses reported seeing some sort of aircraft in the vicinity around the time the jeep exploded. What happened on that Yemeni road in 2002 wasn't exactly a secret, but it wasn't exactly transparent either. Unnamed U.S. officials suggested to the press that the jeep had been targeted in a covert CIA operation and destroyed with Hellfire missiles fired from an unmanned Predator drone. The CIA stayed mum, and so did President Bush. Though Defense Secretary Rumsfeld did comment that it would be a very good thing if Harethi were out of business. Over the next few years, drones became an increasingly valuable tool for U.S. forces in Afghanistan and Iraq. Because they have no human pilots in the cockpit, drones can be sent into situations deemed too dangerous for manned aircraft. And unlike human pilots, drones don't get sleepy or ask for bathroom breaks. This, along with impressive fuel efficiency, gives them long loiter time. They can monitor targets for much longer than manned aircraft. They can be used both for surveillance purposes and to carry out missile strikes. They can even provide close air support to troops engaged in combat. NGO and press reports suggest that it wasn't until 2004 that drone strikes were again used outside the more traditional hot battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. In June 2004, a drone strike killed Nek Mohammed, a Pakistani militant leader, along with at least 6 others, including 2 children. As with the Yemeni strike in 2002, no U.S. officials would go on the record and explain exactly how Nek Mohammed ended up dead. Local residents reported hearing a drone flying nearby, and the New York Times later reported that Mohammed himself had asked one of his followers about the strange metallic bird hovering above him. Pakistani military officials dismissed reports of U.S. involvement as absurd, however, and insisted that Pakistan had the military capabilities to carry out such strikes on its own. Over the ensuing years, the number of U.S. drone strikes outside traditional hot battlefields began to increase, slowly at first, and then more rapidly. In 2005, there were 3 reported drone strikes in Pakistan, followed by 2 more in 2006 and 4 in 2007. In 2008, the last year of the Bush presidency, there were 36. In 2009, the first year of the Obama administration, there were 52. In 2010, there were 122. After that, the number of reported annual strikes began to decline again. In 2014, there were 23 strikes reported. In Yemen, however, the pace of drone strikes picked up even as the number of strikes in Pakistan began to decline. There were no known strikes in Yemen between late 2002 and 2009, followed by 1 in 2010, 9 in 2011, and 47 in 2012, after which the number of annual strikes again began to decline. In 2015, there were reportedly about 22 strikes. Today, the United States is reportedly engaging in similar targeted strikes in Libya, Syria, and elsewhere. All the figures I have just cited are uncertain, however, for the drone war remains a largely covert war. Non-governmental organizations and journalists have compiled information on reported strikes, basing the numbers on witness statements, evidence found at strike scenes, leaked government documents, and statements, usually off the record, by both U.S. and foreign government officials. The publicly available information suggests that U.S. strikes have killed some 3,000 to 5,000 people, but no one knows for sure, just as no one outside the government knows how many of the dead were deliberately targeted and how many were collateral damage. Almost everything publicly known about U.S. drone strikes comes from NGOs and the media. In 2013, for instance, a New York Times story by Mark Mazzetti described a secret deal in which the CIA agreed to kill militants the Pakistani government wanted dead in exchange for access to airspace it had long sought so it could use drones to hunt down its own enemies. Under the terms of the deal, all drone flights in Pakistan would operate under the CIA's covert action authority, meaning that the United States would never acknowledge the missile strikes and that Pakistan would either take credit for the individual killings or remain silent. The Pakistani president at the time was Pervez Musharraf, and according to Mazzetti, he did not think that it would be difficult to keep up the ruse. As he told one CIA officer, in Pakistan, things fall out of the sky all the time. The drone war is a strange sort of war. Everyone knows about it, but officially it barely exists. Until 2012, no one in the executive branch would even go on record acknowledging that the United States had engaged in drone strikes against suspected terrorists. In 2011, U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki was killed in a drone strike in Yemen. But though President Obama acknowledged his death and tacitly acknowledged U.S. responsibility, he kept his comments studiously vague. Earlier this morning, Anwar al-Awlaki, a leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, was killed in Yemen. The death of al-Awlaki marks another significant milestone in the broader effort to defeat al-Qaeda and its affiliates. Furthermore, this success is a tribute to our intelligence community and to the efforts of Yemen and its security forces, who have worked closely with the United States over the course of several years. John Brennan, then the White House counterterrorism advisor, referred publicly to U.S. counterterrorism drone strikes for the first time in a 2012 speech. Yes, in full accordance with the law, and in order to prevent terrorist attacks on the United States and to save American lives, the United States government conducts targeted strikes against specific al-Qaeda terrorists, sometimes using remotely piloted aircraft, often referred to publicly as drones. Brennan did not, however, offer any details. He didn't give numbers, locations of strikes, or the identity of those killed. In 2013, I was in the audience when President Obama himself referred to U.S. drone strikes in a speech at the National Defense University. The United States has taken lethal, targeted action against al-Qaeda and its associated forces, including with remotely piloted aircraft commonly referred to as drones, he said. Like Brennan, he offered almost no specifics, though he assured us that such strikes were both effective and legal. Still, he admitted, as was true in previous armed conflicts, this new technology raises profound questions. Those questions aren't likely to go away. In October 2015, an anonymous Defense Department source gave a raft of classified reports and presentations to a media source, leading to a new round of controversy. According to the press, the leaked documents suggest that the intelligence leading to drone strikes is often far shakier than government public statements suggest, leading to a higher percentage of unidentified casualties than generally acknowledged. What's more, such secret strikes carry a cost. Although captured enemies can provide the United States with valuable information, dead enemies are often literal dead ends from an intelligence-gathering perspective. A devilish invention. For millennia, warriors have searched for ways to kill their enemies from a safe distance. The throwing spear had advantages over swords and clubs, and the longbow had advantages over the spear. Guns, cannons, bomber planes, and ballistic missiles each gave the militaries that first developed them a temporary edge. Historically, virtually every significant advance in distance killing has caused anxiety. The longbow and armor-piercing crossbow were once considered immoral, or at any rate distinctly unchivalrous. In 1139, the Second Lateran Council of Pope Innocent II is said to have prohibited under anathema that murderous art of crossbowmen and archers, which is hateful to God, at least when used against Christians. In the early 1600s, Miguel de Cervantes called artillery a devilish invention, allowing a base cowardly hand to take the life of the bravest gentleman, with bullets coming nobody knows how or from whence. In our own era, the development of weaponized unmanned aerial vehicles has triggered similar controversy and discomfort. To some in the military, drones seem somehow dishonorable. The fact our guys are sitting in safety thousands of miles away, and our targets have no opportunity to surrender. They don't even know their targets. Somehow that just bothers me, one retired general told me, shaking his head. Others worry that drones risk creating a PlayStation mentality, as Philip Alston, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, and Hina Shamsi of the ACLU put it. Young military personnel raised on a diet of video games now kill real people remotely using joysticks. Far removed from the human consequences of their actions, how will this generation of fighters value the right to life? Others still agonize over the civilian casualties that have been caused by drone strikes. But these concerns aren't specific to drones. You can't exactly surrender to a cruise missile either, or to an unseen sniper hiding in the hills. And drones are surely no more video game-like than other modern military technologies, such as laser-guided munitions, remote sensing, satellite imaging, or cameras in the noses of missiles. Those old enough to remember the first Gulf War will recall the once shocking novelty of images taken by cameras inside Tomahawk missiles, the jolting, grainy images in the crosshairs before everything went ominously black. There's also little evidence that drone technologies reduce their operators' awareness of human suffering. If anything, drone operators may have a far greater sense of the harm they help inflict than any sniper or bomber pilot, precisely because the technology enables such clear and long-term visual monitoring. Journalist Daniel Kladman reports the words of one CIA drone operator, a former Air Force pilot. "I used to fly my own air missions. I dropped bombs, hit my target load, but I had no idea who I hit." With drones, it was a different story. "I can look at their faces, see these guys playing with their kids and wives. After the strike, I see the bodies being carried out of the house. I see the women weeping and in positions of mourning. That's not PlayStation. That's real." Increasingly, there is evidence that drone pilots, just like combat troops, can suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. They watch a man play with his children and live his life, sometimes for extended periods of time. And then they drop ordnance on him and see his mangled body. Surely, this takes a psychological toll. A recent Air Force study found that 29% of drone pilots suffered from burnout, with 17% clinically distressed. When it comes to civilian casualties, there is also little reason to focus on drones, per se. To paraphrase the NRA, drones don't kill people, people kill people. At any rate, drone strikes kill civilians at no higher a rate, and almost certainly at a lower rate than most other common means of warfare. Today's unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, carry highly accurate ordnance that generally produces far less widespread damage than other munitions, and their low profile and relative fuel efficiency permit them to spend more time on target than manned aircraft. Unlike pilots of manned aircraft, pilots of unmanned vehicles can regularly be replaced while on a mission to avoid fatigue and ensure greater accuracy. Drones can thus engage in persistent surveillance, spending hours, days, weeks, or even months monitoring a potential target. Equipped with imaging technologies that enable operators thousands of miles away to see details as fine as individual faces, modern drone technologies allow their operators to distinguish between civilians and combatants far more effectively than most other weapon systems. That does not mean that civilians are not killed in drone strikes. They are. But the available evidence suggests that drone strikes cause far fewer unintended casualties than other types of strikes. The lack of transparency makes it impossible to say for sure, but press and NGO analyses suggest that relatively few civilians have been killed in U.S. strikes, particularly in recent years, as technologies have improved and targeting rules have tightened. For the most part, complaints that drones kill civilians or drones kill from a distance are red herrings. We should worry about armed drone technologies, but for a different set of reasons. By lowering or disguising the costs of lethal force, their availability can blind us to the potentially dangerous longer-term consequences of our strategic choices. Armed drones lower the perceived costs of using lethal force in at least three ways. First, drones reduce the cost of using lethal force inside foreign countries. Most drones are a bargain compared with the available alternatives. Manned aircraft, for instance, are quite expensive. Lockheed Martin's F-22 fighter jets cost about $190 million each, and F-35s are roughly $100 million. But the 2015 price of an MQ-9 Reaper drone was $13.7 million, while Predator drones cost only about $5 million to make. Hellfire missiles are a steal at less than $100,000 each. You could buy one with a home equity loan. Second, relying on drone attacks reduces the domestic political costs of using lethal force. Sending special operations forces after a suspected terrorist places the lives of U.S. personnel at risk, and full-scale invasions and occupations endanger even more American lives. In contrast, using armed drones eliminates all short-term risks to the lives of the personnel involved in the operations. And because drone attacks don't involve sustained fighting, active exchanges of fire, or U.S. ground troops, any need for congressional notification and approval under the War Powers Act can conveniently be avoided. Third, by reducing accidental civilian casualties, precision drone technologies reduce the perceived moral and reputational costs of using lethal force. Contrary to assumptions in some quarters, most officials care greatly about avoiding civilian casualties. Even those willing to discount the moral cost of civilian deaths understand the reputational costs. Dead civilians upset local populations and host country governments, alienate the international community, and sometimes even disturb the sleep of American voters. I don't believe that humans can be reduced to homo economicus, but as a group, government officials are remarkably sensitive to financial, political, and reputational costs. Thus, when new technologies appear to reduce the costs of using lethal force, their threshold for deciding to use lethal force correspondingly drops. If killing a suspected terrorist based in Yemen or Somalia or Libya will endanger expensive manned aircraft, the lives of U.S. troops and/or the lives of many innocent civilians, officials will reserve such killings for situations of extreme urgency and gravity, stopping another 9/11, finally getting Osama bin Laden. But if all that appears to be at risk is an easily replaceable drone, officials will be tempted to use lethal force more and more casually. And this, of course, is exactly what has been happening over the last few years. Increasingly, the publicly available information suggests that drone strikes appear to have targeted militants who are lower and lower down the terrorist food chain, rather than terrorist masterminds. Strikes also seem increasingly to target individuals who pose speculative, distant future threats, rather than only those posing urgent or catastrophic threats. And drone strikes have spread ever farther from hot battlefields, migrating from Pakistan to Yemen to Somalia, and according to press reports, to several other states as well. Shot with a machine gun. Although President Obama has himself acknowledged that U.S. drone strikes raise profound questions, it's strangely difficult to articulate just what it is that's troubling about them. Our instinct, that they may lower the threshold for using armed force, is part of it, but perhaps it's also the apparent individualization of warfare that bothers us. We're accustomed to thinking of war as simultaneously awful and purely impersonal. On the rare occasions we pause to think of the war dead, on Memorial Day perhaps, we picture them in their countless serried ranks, the neat symmetrical lines of white headstones at Arlington Cemetery, or images conjured up from half-remembered poems. In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row. For most of the last few centuries, the wartime dead have been equally anonymous to their enemies. In my office, I have an old black and white family photo of 8 smiling young Canadian soldiers posing together in August 1914 on the eve of the First World War. One of those soldiers, jaunty and confident in his high-necked tunic with its gleaming buttons down the front, was a relative of mine. A great-great-uncle, or maybe a cousin, named Robert George McFarlane. On the back of the photo, the names and fates of those grinning young men are listed in my great-grandmother's careful script. L.B. Reynolds, B.T. O'Grady, G.H. Revel, killed. A. Davies, Tom Brown Jr., A.J. Evans, killed. L.B. North, R.G. McFarlane, shot with a machine gun. Thanks to internet archives and a few old family stories, I know a fair amount about Robert George McFarlane. At the time of his death, he was a second lieutenant attached to the British Army's Royal Engineers. He was born in Huntingdon, Quebec, on January 28, 1889. He had a brother named James and a sister named Elsie. He was a Presbyterian, like his Scottish emigrant forebears, and he attended McGill University, graduating in 1910 and finding work as a mining engineer in Nelson, British Columbia. According to Canadian military records, he stood just 5 feet 6 inches tall at the time of his enlistment in 1914, and he had a 38-inch chest. In July 1915, he was badly injured. He recovered, but only to be shot and killed on March 6, 1916, in the Battle of Railway Wood, near Ypres. I know all this, and my great-grandmother, who loved him, knew much more. But the German soldier who killed him knew none of this. The German who pulled the machine gun trigger hadn't been stalking Robert McFarlane for days or weeks, watching his every move, waiting for the perfect moment to end his life. No one in the German military knew anything at all about McFarlane, and presumably they didn't much care. A German soldier shot him, not because he was Robert McFarlane, height 5 feet 6 inches, brother of Elsie and James, but because he was an enemy soldier in a brutal war that killed millions of soldiers. He just happened to be one of them, in the wrong trench at the wrong time. To the friends and families of the dead, war will always seem personal. The dead are beloved brothers, cousins, husbands, sons, daughters, sisters, and wives, each one unique and precious. But to those on the other side, the enemy dead have generally only been numbers. So many rotting corpses in the muddy trenches of Ypres, so many Viet Cong bodies in the jungles of Vietnam, so many dead Iraqi soldiers on Highway 80 north of Al-Jara, their burned flesh merging with the melted metal of their smoldering tanks. Drone strikes are the polar opposite. They're targeted killings, usually aimed at specific known individuals. Most of the time, U.S. officials know quite a lot about those they target. Their names end up on kill lists, precisely because military and intelligence analysts have built up a painstaking dossier on them, sometimes over many years. Between human informants and high-tech surveillance, we often know where our targets were born, where they went to school and college, the names of their siblings and children, their favorite pastimes, and much more. Even those individuals whose names are not known often have detailed dossiers based on their observed behaviors over weeks or months. Their faces and details appear on the baseball cards studied by administration officials and discussed at Terror Tuesday meetings, where individuals are added to, or more rarely removed from, the list of approved targets. My former professor, Harold Hongju Ko, the former dean of Yale Law School and former State Department legal advisor, recalls the jarring intimacy of the targeting reviews. As the dean of Yale Law School, I spent many, many hours looking at the resumes of young 20-year-olds, students, trying to figure out who should be admitted. I now spend a comparable amount of time studying the resumes of terrorists, same age. Often I know their background as intimately as I knew my students. In a 2013 GQ profile, the late journalist Matthew Power wrote of the voyeuristic intimacy between a drone pilot and his targets. A drone pilot could watch the targets drink tea with friends, play with their children, have sex with their wives on rooftops, writhing under blankets. There were soccer matches, and weddings, too. Pilots watch their targets die in agony, too. The smoke clears, and there's pieces of the two guys around the crater. And there's this guy over here, and he's missing his right leg above his knee. He's holding it, and he's rolling around, and the blood is squirting out of his leg, and it's hitting the ground, and it's hot. His blood is hot. But when it hits the ground, it starts to cool off. The pool cools fast. It took him a long time to die. I just watched him. I watched him become the same color as the ground he was lying on. Targeted killings are surely better than indiscriminate killings. After all, parties to a conflict have a legal and moral obligation to try to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. But it's precisely the personalization of killing that makes drone strikes seem uncomfortably similar to assassinations or simple murders. During my time at the Pentagon, I had no direct involvement in planning or approving targeted strikes, though I was one of scores of officials whose work occasionally brought me into contact with the world of deciders and operators, usually to discuss the information effects of a particular drone strike or to debate the long-term legal and political implications of the strikes. But even from my perch on the periphery, I couldn't shake a queasy sense of dismay. How had it come to pass that I, who was skeptical about military approaches to countering terrorism to begin with, could end up sitting calmly in quiet conference rooms, flipping through photos and biographies of young men who would be dead within days. There's something undeniably chilling about a kill list reviewed each week by 100 or so administration officials meeting via video conference. Press reports suggest that President Obama is personally involved in most decisions about who should go on the kill list. The New York Times described the process. This was the enemy, served up in the latest chart from the intelligence agencies. 15 Qaeda suspects in Yemen with Western ties. The mugshots and brief biographies resembled a high school yearbook layout. Several were Americans. Two were teenagers, including a girl who looked even younger than her 17 years. President Obama, overseeing the regular Tuesday counterterrorism meeting of 24 security officials in the White House Situation Room, took a moment to study the faces. After successful strikes, a military officer serving in the Joint Staff Special Operations Office told me, civilian administration officials often ask to see video of the killings. "It's totally fucked up," he said. "We call it kill TV. Those guys always want to come over to the Pentagon and watch the video." It's the secrecy surrounding drone strikes that's most troubling. Wars, the organized use of violence to achieve political ends, to use Clausewitz's formulation, are quintessential public acts. Yes, every war has its secrets, every war has its codes and spies and covert operations, but the wars themselves are no secret. In World War II, the Allies tried hard to keep the Germans from figuring out where and when they would invade France, using classic tools of military deception. But the fact that the United States and Britain were at war with Germany and hoped to push the Germans out of occupied France was no secret. And after the D-Day invasion, the Allies didn't pretend their forces hadn't landed at Normandy. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan also hold secrets, but the American public, and indeed the world, can easily ascertain the basic details. The approximate number of troops deployed at any given time is no mystery, and neither is the budget. Specific operations are generally disclosed after the fact, at least in broad outline. Deaths and injuries of U.S. troops are promptly made public, and journalists willing to take the risks inherent in war reporting can move freely around to report on Iraqi and Afghan casualties. Although there have been some notable exceptions, particularly in the early days of each war, allegations of significant numbers of civilian casualties are also generally acknowledged and investigated by the military. Contrast this to the government's continued silence about the drone war. It took a full decade for the existence of drone strikes against terrorists to be acknowledged, even in the abstract. And as of this writing, the United States has specifically acknowledged its role in the deaths of a handful of individuals, most of them American citizens. We don't know the targeting criteria, or whether the rules for CIA and military drone strikes differ. We don't know the details of the internal process through which targets are vetted. We don't know the chain of command or the details of congressional oversight. The United States does not release the names of those killed or the locations or numbers of strikes, making it impossible to know whether those killed were legitimately viewed as combatants or not. We also don't know the cost of the secret war. How much money has been spent on drone strikes? What's the budget for the related targeting and intelligence infrastructures? How is the government assessing the costs and benefits of counterterrorism drone strikes? That's a lot of secrecy for a targeted killing program that has reportedly caused the deaths of several thousand people. Spooks and special operators. If armed drones are the weapon of choice in America's expanding secret war, intelligence agency operatives and military special operations forces have provided most of the secret war's manpower. Indeed, if the post-9/11 era has been marked by the expansion of the military into traditionally civilian domains, America's secret war epitomizes yet another kind of blurriness, the increasing erosion of any distinctions between the military and the intelligence community. When it comes to counterterrorism strikes, the overt has gone semi-covert, and the covert has gone semi-overt. The CIA has moved increasingly into paramilitary activities, while the military has moved increasingly into what look like covert intelligence activities. These trends are the result of natural and to some extent praiseworthy efforts by the Pentagon and the intelligence community to respond to changing threats with creativity and agility, but the end result is confusion and lack of accountability. Start with the intelligence community. After the CIA debacles of the 1960s and 1970s, remember the Bay of Pigs and the exploding cigar? the intelligence community shifted away from lethal, covert action. A presidential executive order prohibited assassinations, and Congress tightened covert action notification requirements. Espionage remained a dangerous game, operating in a sort of legal twilight. But in the 1980s and 1990s, the intelligence community focused mainly on collection and analysis rather than on the covert use of force. The 9/11 Commission report concluded that prior to 9/11, many in the intelligence community in fact believed that using covert lethal force was prohibited. After 9/11, this changed fast. CIA personnel were the first American government agents to enter Afghanistan, paving the way for Army Special Forces. In some cases, CIA personnel fought and died alongside Afghan Northern Alliance soldiers. CIA personnel also participated actively in the Battle of Tora Bora and Operation Anaconda, and in the years that followed, the CIA has substantially beefed up its paramilitary side, recruiting heavily within the military special operations community. Today, the CIA is widely reported to engage in raids against high-value terrorist targets and is reportedly responsible for scores, possibly hundreds, of drone strikes. Officially, none of this is happening. Or rather, although U.S. officials are happy enough to take credit for turning live terrorists into dead terrorists, the U.S. government officially insists whether or not the CIA has the authority to be or is in fact directly involved in targeted lethal operations remains classified. What's more, asserts a 2012 Justice Department legal brief, notwithstanding widespread reports that drone strikes occur, the CIA has never confirmed or denied whether it has any involvement or intelligence interest in any of those drone strikes. In response to Freedom of Information Act requests for records relating to drone strikes, the CIA itself has been unambiguously ambiguous. Writing to the ACLU, for instance, the CIA's Information and Privacy Coordinator offered only a stock response. The CIA can neither confirm nor deny the existence or non-existence of records responsive to your request. The fact of the existence or non-existence of requested records is currently and properly classified. So is the CIA conducting lethal drone strikes or not? The investigative journalism group ProPublica has compiled a list of press reports in which anonymous senior officials have discussed those reported CIA drone strikes, together with seemingly confirmatory quotes from several people who ought to know, including former Secretary of Defense and former CIA Director Leon Panetta and President Obama. In 2009, for instance, then CIA Director Panetta responded to a reporter's question about CIA drone strikes by saying, "These operations have been very effective. I can assure you that in terms of that particular area, it is very precise, and it is very limited in terms of collateral damage. And very frankly, it's the only game in town in terms of confronting and trying to disrupt the al-Qaeda leadership." 2 years later, after taking over the helm at DOD, Panetta cheerfully told a military audience, "Having moved from the CIA to the Pentagon, obviously I have a hell of a lot more weapons available to me in this job than I had at the CIA, although the Predators weren't bad." What happens when activities that are officially covert become so extensive and sustained that they effectively move into the overt world? We know someone is using drones to go after Pakistani militants, and the U.S. military insists that it's not them. After a decade of drone strikes and dead bodies, it gets harder and harder to insist that what the CIA is doing is covert. As former Director of National Intelligence Dennis Blair put it in December 2011, "Covert action that goes on for years doesn't generally stay covert. If something has been going for a long period of time, somebody else ought to do it, not intelligence agencies." But even as covert CIA lethal activities appear to have become more and more overt, more and more military activities appear to be moving into the covert realm. In particular, the role of special operations forces, Navy SEALs, Army Green Berets, Air Force Special Tactics, and the like, has dramatically expanded in recent years. And special operations forces are increasingly engaging in activities designed to remain unattributable and unacknowledged. After 9/11, the expansion of special operations forces activities was virtually inevitable. America's conventional general-purpose forces are fantastically good with tanks and artillery and moving large numbers of people and machines from one place to another. And as the 1991 Gulf War demonstrated, they can roll over enemy armies with ease. But as we know, terrorist organizations don't fight like conventional armies. They eschew uniforms and traditional military command structures and rely instead on stealth, subterfuge, and asymmetrical attack. They blend easily into local civilian populations. As a result, they often confound American conventional forces. Special operations forces, in contrast, were designed to handle unconventional threats. Various organizations within the SOF community emphasize different skills. SEALs take pride in their ability to conduct lightning raids on high-value targets. The raid on Osama bin Laden's compound is a classic example. Army Special Forces emphasize their ability to keep a low profile and work closely with foreign armed forces, something that takes sophisticated linguistic and